I think we are the product of having lived in a country that's very favorable to Christianity for a long time. And honestly, we're just not ready for a world that's not. Where in the second century, they didn't have the luxury of a country that was in their corner. They had developed, because they were forced to, how to make the case for Christianity in a more sophisticated way because they lived in such a hostile world. And I think we've lost that. So you could argue we've gotten a little flabby around the middle here, and that, you know, there's nothing like, you know, a new fitness regime to get you back in shape. But I think our Christian church needs it.
5 centuries ago, in taverns and public houses across Europe, the masses would gather for discussion and debate over the latest ideas sweeping the land. From one such meeting place, a small Cambridge inn called the White Horse, the Reformation came to the English-speaking world. Carrying on the tradition, welcome to the White Horse Inn.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the White Horse Inn. I'm Shane Rosenthal. And joining me for this program is Dr. Michael Kruger, who is the president of Reformed Theological Seminary in Charlotte, North Carolina. We had him on the program last year to talk about the Ten Commandments of Progressive Christianity. And on this episode, I'll be talking with him about his new book, Surviving Religion 101, Letters to a Christian Student on Keeping the Faith in College. So, Dr. Kruger, welcome back to the Inn.
Thanks, Shane. Good to be back on the show.
So why don't you start off by telling our listeners what this new book is about and what motivated you to write it?
Yeah, this book is unique in a number of ways for me. I think most aptly, it's a bit autobiographical. So I start off by telling the story of my own experience in college years ago at UNC Chapel Hill, where I found myself in a religion class, religion 101, so to speak, where I didn't have answers to very hard questions getting thrown my way. And ever since then, I've always wanted to write a book that would help college students navigate the complex intellectual questions they would face. But the other motivating factor here is that now my oldest child, my daughter Emma, is a student at UNC Chapel Hill herself. So she's a rising junior there, and it seems like things have now come full circle. And so I really wrote the book for her, for all college students, but really for her in hopes of preparing her for college. So it's a really special book in all those ways.
You know, in your preface, you talk about the frequency with which Christian students head off to college and then return with a substantially different worldview. Why do you think it is that so many of those raised in conservative Christian homes aren't better prepared to handle the challenges that they'll face by the time they head off to college?
Yeah, this is a curious question. You're right. I bring up the question in my introduction, and I don't actually ever answer it in the book. Of course, the book is written for people after they've already arrived in college, and whether they've had good preparation or bad, I'm trying to help them. But there is the sort of deeper, more foundational question here, which is, well, how did the church get here? In terms of being in a position where we're losing a good chunk of our own young folks who head off to college. And I've pondered that. I don't know if I have all the answers. I won't mention one possibility. Well, there's several possibilities. But one thing I think I've noticed is that I'm not sure most Christian parents and even churches have necessarily the right perspective on how to introduce their kids to non-Christian thought. And I think there's this idea that a lot of parents operate kind of like the same way they do with germs and sickness, which is hyper-concerned about all germs, use sanitation wipes and hand sanitizer, never let my kid get sick, and you think you've produced a healthy child. The problem with that, though, of course, as scientists are now showing, is that if you don't have some sort of early introduction to some germs, the immune system never really kicks in, and you can actually end up with a sicker child later. Well, I think there's something true there spiritually. I think churches, pastors, parents aren't doing the kind of exposure of our children to bite-sized chunks of non-Christian thinking that they can handle and teaching them how to respond to those things. And so students are getting to college and they're hearing these things for the first time. And I mean, that was my situation.
Yeah,
I got to college. I grew up in a solid Christian home with a great youth ministry and loving parents who knew Christ, but yet I never heard these things before. And so I think the church has got to do a better job introducing these things to the folks before they get there so they can say they heard it from their own church or their own parents rather than from their professor.
You know, in the introduction to his book, What is Faith?, Princeton theologian J. Gresham Machen claimed back in his day that Christian families, churches, and educational institutions were in a state of crisis because they'd essentially failed to pass on the basic tenets of the Christian faith to the next generation because, in his words, they began to consider, quote, solely applications of Christianity without studying the Christianity that is to be applied.
Yeah.
And so he concluded that this was rooted in a, quote, great spiritual movement, which has been going forward during the last 100 years, at the heart of which was what he called the depreciation of the intellect and the exaltation of the feelings and of the will. What do you think about the point Machen is making there? And do you think he was onto something?
Yeah, I think he is onto something. I think the intellectual sort of state of the modern evangelical church is in a crisis. I think there's a strain of anti-intellectualism that has pervaded evangelicalism for years. And I think that's part of the problem, is that there's a love God with our heart, love God with our actions, but not so much love God with our mind issue. I'll add another layer to it, though, and I think Machen's hinting at this. What I like to tell my students is you've got a bigger job than that. You need to more than inform, you need to persuade. And one of the things that I think that's missing in most modern preaching and modern teaching is the persuasion dimension.
So it's not just the what you believe, but also the why you believe it kind of thing?
Why you believe it and why it makes sense and why you ought to embrace this line of thinking. And so telling someone about the truth is one thing. Persuading them of the truth is another. Now, on one level, I think most people assume, well, I don't need to persuade the church I'm in because they're all Christians. But first of all, A, maybe some of them aren't. But then B, even Christians need to be persuaded.
Yeah.
And so you realize that the art of persuasion, I think, is lost in the modern church. And I really think there's a place there to recover that. And if we did, I think we would be in better shape than we are today.
Do you think part of the way to recovery there is just to go back to look at the book of Acts and see what it was that they were doing in the first century as they were making the case for Christianity and reasoning with men in the synagogues and at Mars Hill?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think you've got Acts 17 and other places that can give you some guidelines there. But even beyond Acts 17 or even the New Testament writings, I think you look at the early apologetics movements in the second century. I mean, they had developed, because they were forced to, how to make the case for Christianity in a more sophisticated way because they lived in such a hostile world. I think we are the product of having lived in a country that's very favorable to Christianity for a long time. And honestly, we're just not ready for a world that's not.
Yeah.
And we're in the second century. They didn't have the luxury of a country that was in their corner. They had to step up and make a good argument. And I think we've lost that. So you could argue we've gotten a little flabby around the middle here and that, you know, there's nothing like, a new fitness regime to get you back in shape. But I think our Christian church needs it. Now, on the flip side, I think we also could say, and I actually say this in my book in the last chapter, that also we don't want to make the opposite mistake where we think sort of intellectual assent to truths is enough to keep people on the track in their Christian life.
Yeah, it's a spiritual and an intellectual problem.
Exactly. I'd say it repeatedly. You're not following ideas. You're following a person. If you just follow ideas, you're also going to find yourself headed down the path where this just isn't satisfying to you anymore. I mean, the ultimate satisfaction is, of course, the Christian worldview, but it's the Christian worldview wrapped around a person, namely Christ. And so both of these in tandem are key. And Machen was facing the weaknesses in his day, and many of those are still here. And then we also need to address what other weaknesses are in our day. And so, you know, both heart and mind together are going to be really key.
Do you think that another part of the problem is that while it's true that most conservative Christians are not preparing their kids for the real challenges that they will have to face, like on a college campus, but also that most of our colleges and educational institutions themselves have become exponentially more secular and progressive, in fact, evangelistically so?
Yeah, there's no doubt that's the case. So you clearly, and I talk about this in the introduction too, the state of the modern university is discouraging. It's not doing what it says it's supposed to do, which is to introduce people to the swath of ideas out there and have a discussion about which ones are more persuasive. And I think, honestly, the modern university is becoming more of an indoctrination movement than a classical liberal education should be. And I use liberal there in a different way than maybe most people hear it. I mean liberal in the sense of truly allowing all views on the table, which is what historically universities were supposed to be doing. And it's really sad to see that's changed. Now, I will add one caveat to that, even though I think we all could agree that the situation on the college campus today is as hostile as ever. It's not as if, you know, 100 years ago, people weren't struggling with these same things, or even 75 years ago. In my opening chapter of my book, I actually have a quote from the 1920s in an article in The Atlantic, where the person there, Philip Wentworth, basically says, everyone knows that college hurts the religious beliefs of college students. You can see there that even though modern universities today are not in a great position, this is not a new problem. This is always going to come up anytime people go to higher education, and we just need to be ready for it.
But if it's indoctrination, does that sort of change the way we think? I mean, if you were going to send your kids to essentially a Hindu seminary to get basic education, you may want to think about preparing them for the kinds of things you're going to get indoctrinated in Hinduism before you send them there, if you want them to maintain their Christian faith.
Absolutely. And this is part of the reason I wrote my book, is to help, hopefully, even seniors in high school and folks like that work through the issues they're going to face, because you can't go in blind, you can't go in naive. Now, on the flip side, you can't go in overly pessimistic either, where you think the world's ending and, you know, every one of my professors is Darth Vader trying to kill me and this sort of thing. I've seen that, too. And there is a martyr complex that evangelical students can create, where they become overly defensive and sort of become the victims of every comment that's made in a classroom. And we've got to be careful there too. But yes, it's a hostile place, probably as hostile as it's ever been. And churches and parents need to take note.
So some years ago, I took some recording equipment to a secular college campus and asked students what they thought about the Bible. And I'd like to have you listen to some of the answers that I received.
What are your thoughts about the Bible in particular? Do you think it's fiction? Do you think it's nonfiction? What do you think?
Personally, I think most of it is fiction. I hesitate to trust any book that's been revised that much. There's this nice book I'd recommend called Misquoting Jesus.
Barterman.
Yeah, where it talks about how isn't it the most translated book in all of history? I think it's at least really up there. And they didn't have, printing presses or nice translators. It was up to the scribe to just say, hey, this sounds like this, but this sounds kind of stupid. I'm going to take this out and I might put this in. And it's really just so up to human error that the English copy that we have today compared to the original works of these people is probably not all that similar. So
the thing about the Bible is that I think it's been mistranslated. I think the Bible as a whole is just, it's a wonderful work, but if you can maybe take some ambiguities in there and really just kind of, skew them.
Well, it's definitely not complete fiction, because there's truth in it. I just don't trust its claim to be like the one and only book, the be-all, end-all. It has been translated and retranslated multiple times, and then you have missing books from it. And
so what's it rooted in then? The idea that it's been translated and it's had revisions over the years. How do you know that? What have you studied?
What have I studied?
Mm-hmm.
Learned it in class.
So Dr. Kruger, what did you think about those responses?
Well, I mean, anybody who's in this area is probably not surprised by those responses. Even the first person there mentioned Misquoting Jesus by Bart Ehrman. Ehrman's had a big impact on people's perceptions about the reliability of the Bible, particularly the New Testament, and mainly around the issue of how it's been transmitted and copied over time. I mentioned earlier in our discussion that I had a professor who was very critical of the Bible as an undergrad at UNC, and that professor actually was Bart Ehrman. I actually had him as a professor years ago.
Yeah.
And I heard all those arguments when I was 19 sitting in a classroom and, of course, was woefully unprepared to deal with them.
You said that it basically rattled your faith.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It threw me into a bit of a crisis. Like, is everything I believe a lie? Is this true? Or can I trust it? And the people around me who were Christians were in a very similar position. And of course, he's been teaching these classes for 20 some years now, almost 30 years now.
I was surprised how pervasive that thesis that the Bible is not trustworthy has become. I mean, his work has gotten out there.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if you just look at it in terms of just numerical success, I mean, his book is a New York Times bestseller. And then, of course, he's very big in public media in a variety of ways. So, yeah, it's hard to compete with that. But listening to the comments of the students, though, you can tell that they've got a sort of a half-baked version of Ehrman's arguments. I think Ehrman's arguments themselves are problematic, but they don't even understand Ehrman's arguments.
Right.
As an example of this, they use the term translation rather than transmission, which is just a mistaken term here. The issue is not translation, as if the Bible getting translated in other languages is the problem. The problem is transmission, how it's copied by scribes over time. And so clearly they don't understand the categories. The other mistake they make is they assume that if there's some changes that the whole thing is unreliable and that we can't know what is said. And clearly they're not aware of the very good condition our collective manuscript tradition is in as a whole. And we are in a fantastic place to know what the New Testament authors originally said. And so it's a hyper-skeptical view that, of course, Ehrman has fed. And here's the reality. People just want that to be true. They
right.
want you to be able to say that we can't know what the books really said. And so they, without much investigation, just latch onto it. The problem is it just isn't true. And I and others have written on it to show why it's not true.
You actually say that the more you looked into these things, the more you realized what you received in your Religion 101 class was basically indoctrination, because it was so skewed to that skeptical, critical side. You ended up becoming a New Testament scholar as a result. What are some of the quick arguments that you would give to students who are confronted with these ideas?
Well, yeah, when I was an undergraduate, of course, I heard these arguments and had no idea how to respond. And I looked around and other people were just dealing with it in their own way. Some were sort of pretending it wasn't happening, kind of stick their head in the sand. Others were sort of giving up entirely. And then others were looking for some sort of compromise view. What I decided to do is to ask the question whether any Christian scholars had ever addressed these things before. Surely, I thought to myself, this isn't the first time this argument's been made. It's not like in in 1990 or whenever I had this class, that this is the first time someone's thought of these arguments. And so I started doing my investigative work. And I stumbled across, you know, a couple of well-known scholars in textual criticism, Bruce Metzger, who's ironically Ehrman's mentor, yeah. and then other scholars like F.F. Bruce and others who've written on, you know, the transmission of the New Testament and New Testament canon and so on. And the short version is I learned there's a whole other side of the story. The manuscript tradition actually is remarkably reliable. In fact, as good as, if not better than anything we have in yep. antiquity. And then on top of that, the canon is not nearly so much a free-for-all as people indicate, as if we have all these books that have been blocked or kept out, but rather there was a consolidation around a core canon very early. So as soon as I realized those two things, I realized, okay, I'm getting half the story at best half the story, and I need to fill it in with the other half. And that's what I did. And that took me on a new path where I ended up eventually becoming a New Testament scholar myself.
Yeah, it's hard to talk about all the errors in the Bible if you don't really know what the original is. So if it's all fluid, then how can you talk about mistakes in the text? You have to sort of assume what the real thing is to be able to distinguish the truth from the copy mistake.
Well, yeah, I mean, this has been pointed out about Ehrman's original book, because misquoting Jesus is just a popular version of a book called The Orthodox Corruption of Scripture, which he wrote in 93. And the critiques of that book were similar. It's like, well, okay, yeah, everyone knows there's textual variations, but the only way you know it's a variation off the original is if you know there is an original. And so the whole book presumes that therefore we can't know the original, but it actually presupposes you know the original in order to say there's variations. And so you realize it's a bit of a circular argument. And so the upshot is that the textual tradition of the New Testament is very reliable. There are challenges that we need to address as they come up. Sure, we're not naive about those. But the idea that it throws into wild conjecture the teachings of the Bible is silly.
You discussed the idea in one of your early chapters that many students are likely to face. Namely, my professors are really smart, so isn't it more likely that they're right and I'm wrong? How do you address this one?
Yeah, this is a big one. This is one I started off early in the book addressing. People ask me, what is the biggest objection that people struggle with? And you know, you can never pinpoint that because everybody's different. But I've got to put this on the top of the list somewhere because I'm convinced that this is one of the bigger issues that college students face. And the way I say it is it's just a numbers game. What happens is students show up at a college campus and they knew it intuitively. But it's different when you're sitting there and it dawns on them that basically every professor, with a few exceptions, thinks I'm crazy. Basically, every professor with a lot of letters behind their names, trained in some of the best schools in the world, all think differently than me. And add to that, basically, you know, a large percentage of all my fellow students, aside from my campus groups, think that also that Christianity is kind of crazy and doesn't make any sense. And so they just pause for a second and think, OK, what's the chance that all of them are wrong and that I'm right?
Yeah.
Now, if you think about it, that sounds like a pretty crazy thing to think about, too, right? Like, have we ever thought about that? Well, what's the chance everybody's wrong and we're the ones right? So, you know, every PhD is wrong, but me, my 19-year-old self is right. And so the student just can't come to grips with that. Now, the way I respond to that is I just point out that lurking behind that objection or that concern is a misunderstanding of the way people form their beliefs. If people form their beliefs just on facts and evidence, then that would be a fair response, which is I must not have the right evidence or the right facts. But what if people didn't form their beliefs that way? What if your professor actually didn't reach the conclusions they reached because of facts and because of evidence, but based on the way they interpret those facts inside a pre-existing worldview? And so I make the case through my book that, you know, the professors aren't neutral. They're starting with their own paradigm, their own worldview, and they interpret things within it. So in other words, they reach a little bit of a foregone conclusion, regardless of what the data says. And we just need to realize that people don't reach their conclusions the way we think they do. And once you get that, and once you realize, of course, the added dimension that people need the Holy Spirit to help them see the truth of Christianity, then you realize, okay, the numbers game doesn't quite say everything that needs to be said.
Do you think another part of the problem is that humans are in some ways more herd animals than we realize? You know, we are very persuaded by the fact that we're the only one who believes a certain thing. Most people believe X, therefore I should believe X. Do you think that's part of it too?
Oh, yeah. I mean, and of course, that there's no doubt that's true. And it, by the way, it's not just true in religion. It's true in all parts of life.
Yeah.
It's true in politics.
Yep.
It's true in what clothes you buy and what soda you drink. It's dictated by what you think is going to fit in with the trends of your world. And you don't want to be left out. You don't want to be the odd one out. You don't want to be in the minority. So yeah, it's a human proclivity that I'm sure we could psychoanalyze why it's that way. But no one wants to be the odd man out. And then you take the evangelical student and they're like, wow, I'm a pariah around here. And, you know, that's a very disconcerting thing. And they're looking for the exits already because of the social pressure. And then if you give them a good intellectual argument, or at least what seems to be a good intellectual argument, then they have all they need to walk out the exit. So we need to make sure we don't give them both those things.
Yeah. So as you're no doubt aware, there are a lot of sincere people who hold completely different worldviews and religions. So how are we to say that Christianity is the only true religion?
Yeah, well, I have a whole chapter, as you know, in the book on the exclusivity of Christianity and all the objections that fly off the shelf as soon as you claim that. And, you know, this is going to be one of the big hangups for Christian college students. And honestly, not just college students, all of us, right? We live in a very pluralistic world. We are claiming something unique, which is that you should only follow and worship Jesus and him only, and that therefore he's the one true God. And that's very offensive to people. Now, there's lots of ways to respond to that, the people's objections are there, because it depends on the objection. Some people say, well, that's remarkably arrogant. You know, how can you say you're the only right religion? I mean, you're saying you're the only one that's figured it out. And of course, I respond in my book because that's a misunderstanding of what religion is, at least on the Christian system. For secular people, religion is working your way to God and trying to figure out what God is like. And if you just say, I have the only right religion, then in people's ears, what they're hearing is, I'm the only one that's worked hard enough, studied enough to figure out what God is like.
Right.
But that's not the Christian claim. The Christian claim isn't that Christians are smarter or more hardworking than other people. Rather, our claim is that God has revealed himself to his people by grace. In other words, the fact that we know the truth isn't because we're better, smarter, or worked harder at it, but because God is a speaking God and he's spoken. And so this takes away the claim of arrogance. There's nothing arrogant about believing God when he reveals himself to you. It doesn't mean that you think you're better than anybody else. And so I think right out of the gate, I try to help the college students see that this isn't an arrogance thing. This isn't a pride thing. I think some people think the exclusive claims of Christianity are like a kind of like a sports event where you cheer, we're number one, you know, as if it's like, we're better than you.
Yeah.
Well, that's not what's going on. It's just about the fact that we think God has revealed himself and we're just simply following that.
But what if all the religions of the world are sort of like the blind man feeling the different parts of the elephant? You know, one person's feeling the tail, another the tusk, another the leg. They all seem like different parts, but it's the one and the same elephant.
Yeah. So people are basically saying, you know, all religions are true. They're all a little bit of a piece of the same thing. Well, that falls apart on multiple levels. For one, you know, a lot of these religions just flatly contradict each other. So they can't all be true. You know, somebody's wrong unless you throw out the laws of logic.
Yeah.
Either Jesus rose from the dead bodily or he didn't. And, you know, the Muslims say no. Christians say yes. So, I mean, you've got a very big contradiction there. But the other problem with the elephant analogy, the blind men found the elephant, is that the person using the analogy pretends that he can see the whole elephant. In other words, the person using the analogy says, let me tell you how religion really works. Here's how religion really works. And he lays it all out for you. But I'm like, but are you not yourself blind?
Yeah.
So in other words, the person using the analogy is exempting themselves from their own rules. And this just tells you the hypocrisy of the whole thing, which is they want to pretend like they're not arrogant in their claims. But at the end of the day, what you realize is they're actually making grand sweeping truth claims about what they know and don't know. It's just they have no divine revelation to back it up. At least Christians claim to have divine revelation when we make grand sweeping truth claims.
The way you put it in your book, I thought was funny. You know, what if the elephant also spoke?
Yeah. Yeah. What if the elephant told you what he's like?
Yeah.
or what he is? You know, you say an elephant's a tree trunk, an elephant's a snake. What if the elephant says, no, here's what I'm like. Here's who I am. Well, then obviously you couldn't say that everyone's just figuring it out, because now it's not about figuring it out. It's about receiving what the elephant's told you.
Yeah. And if God ends up becoming man and suffers at the hands of men and claims that his death is an atonement for sin, why would he have to die if all religions are true? That's kind of an extreme solution if it's just one option among many.
Yeah, well, I make the point about the internal logic of the exclusive claims of Christianity. This is a missing piece in a lot of arguments. Some people think that Christians claim to be the only right religion just because we want to.
Yeah.
Or because we're trying to prove we're better or something. But what they miss is the only reason we claim we're the only way to heaven is because of the person of Jesus. He's the only one who's paid for sins. So I make a point in the book is that in a conversation with somebody, you could say, hey, do you have another way to pay for sins I'm unaware of? Because if you do, then we can put that on the table and have a conversation about it. But barring any other option where God is satisfied, you know, with a payment for sins, Jesus is your only way. And so the idea that Jesus is the only way to God is just another way of saying he's the only one who can pay for sins. And so the exclusivity of Christianity is just about the uniqueness of the person of Jesus. Jesus is what makes Christianity different. So we just keep focusing on him and pointing people back to him.
Yeah. And, you know, at least as a starting place, if you have someone who dies and doesn't stay dead, you might just check out his words. It's at least a place to start.
Yeah. I mean, it might be someone worth listening to, right? Especially if they predicted they would.
Right. You have a chapter that deals with the issue of morality and the perception that many Christians are likely to have on a secular campus that their views are hateful and intolerant. How do you tackle this one?
Yeah, I think we all feel this in our culture today, whether you're a college student or not. And college students particularly feel this because they have a set of moral beliefs And those moral beliefs are not just some beliefs that people disagree with. That's one thing, but they're moral beliefs that people find, you know, morally reprehensible and offensive and abhorrent. And so what happens to college students is they get on the college campus and they start hearing that and they think to themselves, man, I must be a bad person. I must be a hateful person. Maybe I ought to change my views so I'm less hateful. And I write a whole chapter trying to deal with this idea of moral claims. And there's several things I point out. One of the fundamental things to point out, of course, is that it's not just Christians making moral absolute claims.
Right.
This idea that everybody else is a moral relativist and that Christians are moral absolutists, as if that's the debate. That's not the debate.
Yeah, there's a lot of moral outrage on campuses today.
Yeah, there's a tremendous amount of moral outrage on campuses over a great many things. And so the person on the one hand may tell the Christian, hey, stop shoving your beliefs down my throat. Morals are relative. And then the flip side, the next day they're out picketing against the pollution of the environment or the mistreatment of migrants at the border or what have you. And you realize, wait a second, I thought you said morality was relative. They end up having to sort of realize, and the non-Christian has to eventually admit that he has his own set of moral absolutes. Now, of course, that doesn't end the discussion because now you just shift gears and ask the question, okay, so you have moral absolutes and I do. Which worldview is the worldview that can account for these? At least yeah. I have a reason as a Christian for why I think things are right or wrong. What's your reason? You know, if you're an atheist, do you have any reason to think things are morally right or wrong in any absolute way? And you realize very quickly that the non-Christian has moral absolutes in his system, but no basis for it. In fact, his system, if it were true, would actually undercut his moral norms. And so this is where you want to go at that point in the discussion.
So let's move from the issue of morality in general to homosexuality in particular. How should we counsel a student who says, quote, I have gay friends who are kind, wonderful, and happy. So are we sure that homosexuality is wrong? It doesn't seem to hurt anyone.
Yeah. One of the chapters, of course, I have in the book, and you couldn't have any book for college students without a chapter on sexuality and in particular, homosexuality. There's many other things I could have mentioned, and maybe there'll be a different version of this book down the road where I add transgender issues, because that's the new news now, right?
Yep.
Many other corollary issues. But I just focused on the homosexual issue because obviously it's a big one and it's been around a while. You know, the reason people change their views on homosexuality aren't always what we think they are. You know, one of the things I bring up in the book is sometimes they go to a college campus and they end up having friends who are gay
yep.
that they really like and that are friendly and kind and seem very happy. And then it dawns on them, wait a second, I don't understand. How is it that these people who embrace this wrong moral position seem like good people? And then it just sort of starts to unravel their whole worldview. Well, what I point out is that the fact that they're surprised by that is actually part of the theological problem. People haven't been taught the concept of common grace. The idea of common grace, of course, is this concept that you don't have to be a believer to do externally good things.
Right.
You don't have to be a believer to be a nice person, that God restrains sin in non-Christians by his common grace so that they could even be positive contributors to society and so on. So what you realize is that all of us on some level are a mix of good parts and bad parts, if I can say it that way, good and evil. We have an old self and a new self as Christians. And even though the non-Christian doesn't have a new self yet because they're not regenerate, they still have the image of God in them
yeah.
that can withhold sin. So what you find is lots of times the people that we meet as non-Christians can be very kind. In fact, I always make the joke. I was like, the nicest people I know aren't even Christians.
Yeah.
That, you know, when I was living in Arizona years ago, I knew a lot of Mormons. And I got to tell you, they were a lot nicer than the Christians were. And you realize you can't form your basis of belief on that alone. You have to ask what's true. And when you look at the Bible is very clear about homosexuality. And it's very clear that you could be someone who embraces that and still be kind in other ways. And those two things are not mutually exclusive.
Do you think at its root, the messages we hear so frequently in pop culture, you know, about following your heart and being yourself, basically boil down to a denial of the doctrine of original sin?
Oh, yeah. This is something that we all hear all the time. Follow your heart, be true to yourself. But all of that presupposes something, and that is it presupposes that your heart is good, or it presupposes that your true self is the self you ought to follow. But what if your heart isn't good? Or what if the true self's a bad self? You know, the biblical message isn't follow your true self, it's to deny yourself. The biblical message isn't that the solution's inside of you. The biblical message is the problem's inside of you, original sin. And so what you realize is those kinds of messages already presuppose a worldview, namely a non-Christian one. Once you start thinking Christianly, you realize, well, wait a second, just because I want to do something, just because I feel inclined towards something, doesn't inherently make it good. Well, I might need to reject my own inclinations. And by the way, the world admits this in other categories. So, you know, if you tell an alcoholic hey, stop drinking. And the alcoholic says, hey, but I really have this inclination to drink and I feel like that's who I am and what I want to do. No one's going to say, oh, okay, well, then you're fine. Keep doing it. No, they're going to say, deny yourself. Stop.
Yeah.
Right. And so there's a sense in which we need to recognize that that can be true too for sexual urges. Just because you have them doesn't make them good.
Or even things like, you know, systemic racism. There are those who push that and say, white people are systemically racist. They're born with this propensity, whether it's true or not. That seems to be a view that says, whatever the case, you shouldn't act on those impulses, right? I mean, that's what they're saying.
Yeah, that's right. That's another example in our culture where people admit that if you have a built-in inclination, sometimes it's wrong.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think you can make an argument that humans have a built-in inclination to prefer other humans that are like them.
I agree.
Or that have the same skin color of them. But I think we also could say that the built-in inclination to prefer people of the same skin color should be rejected.
Right.
Because it's going to lead to all kinds of racial discrimination. And so, yeah, it's funny how sexuality is the one thing plucked out of the system that all the rules get broken for. Whereas it's common sense prevails more in other areas, but not in that area. It seems like in that area, it's just all bets are off.
Yeah. So according to this new worldview of, you know, just be yourself, that kind of becomes, you know, a liberating message for those who no longer wish to repress their sexual predilection, their identity. And it kind of becomes a new gospel, doesn't it? I mean, where you don't have to conform to anyone else's standard. The way I am is beautiful because that's how I was made.
Oh, yeah. Let's not underestimate the power of that narrative. The idea that we're being liberated from an oppressive force over us and that we're setting ourselves free to be who we are, man, that is incredibly powerful and convincing, and it pervades our modern culture. It baptizes your own inclinations. And like we already said, what if your inclinations are dark? Then what?
Yeah.
Just put a really brash face on it. I mean, when you look at the serial killers out there, they say that from a very young age, they thought about horrible things in their brain and they had inclinations to kill people. And it kind of haunted them. And then eventually they acted on them. Couldn't you argue they're just acting on what is inside of them?
And therefore,
are they just being themselves?
Right.
And so you realize, obviously, that never works.
Yeah. What do you say to a student who begins to read material from Matthew Vines or others who argue that it's okay to be gay and Christian?
Yeah, so this is another angle that you have to deal with in the arguments around homosexuality. There's a group out there, what's known as the gay Christian movement, which kind of wants to have their theological cake and eat it too. And what I mean is they want to say, hey, I believe in all the historic Orthodox doctrines. And I also think that you can embrace homosexuality along with those and hold those together. And, you know, that movement's made some headway. I think that movement obviously is deeply problematic. I appreciate the fact that they're trying to hold the Orthodox doctrine. I think we can commend the effort there and so on. But the idea that you can tack on this idea that homosexual activity is blessed by God, I think it runs in the face of a number of challenges. One, of course, is the biblical texts themselves. I make the point in my book that, you know, all the arrows in the Bible point away from that argument and point towards the idea that the Bible rejects homosexual behavior.
And not just the Old Testament.
Yes, exactly. I mean, this is repeated in the New. We have all kinds of evidence of what God thinks about sex and marriage and so on. It's just not even close, honestly. And what's difficult about the gay Christian movement is it would be much more honest, in my opinion, for them just to say, I've embraced homosexuality as good, and now I realize the Bible is just wrong. I realize now the Bible's wrong. That would be the honest answer,
yeah,
where you just realize I can't be a Christian anymore, which, by the way, historically, that's what happened. When people would embrace homosexuality in the past, they had recognized that they can't still be Christians because the Bible condemns it.
Yeah.
So they just realized these two are not compatible. But now there's this attempt to make them compatible. I think it's not an honest attempt. I think you've got to just admit the Bible doesn't go there, and you just sort of just have to make your choice at that point.
Why is this sin such a big deal to the God of the Bible?
Yeah, you know, one of the points I make in one of my chapters is that not all sins are equal in terms of their effects, and not all sins are equal in terms of the damage they do, and that there is a, if I could use this term, a ranking of sins. Some sins are more troubling than others. In the world of sexual sin, and there's lots of different kinds of sexual sin, by the way, we certainly can say at a minimum that homosexuality is certainly a big deal in the Bible. God does not minimize it or play it down. It's a big problem. Why is it that gets sort of the big press? Well, I think at the core, and Paul makes this point in Romans 1, there is something that swims against nature in the homosexual activity that I think is an affront to the God who made us. When we exchange the system that God gave us for one that he didn't give us, it's an affront to the Creator. That's one. The other is the purpose of marriage. Marriage is supposed to be a picture of Christ and the church and the way that Christ loves his church. If you tinker with marriage and mess it up, you end up attacking that image. Now, by the way, homosexuality is not the only way to mess up marriage. And here's where I think the church could use some honest self-reflection. It's not like, you know, we were doing a great job on marriage until now.
Right.
I mean, the divorce rate and the many other problems that we see modern marriages have, you know, has the church adequately dealt with those things? I think we could all say probably not. And so, you know, this isn't the only thing that threatens marriage, but certainly, you know, homosexuality takes marriage and flips it on its head. And in as much as it does that, I think that's why the Bible considers it a big deal.
You also have a chapter that deals with the seemingly barbaric and cruel doctrine of hell. And you interact with the views of people like Rob Bell, who ask, you know, has God created billions of people over thousands of years only to select a few to go to heaven and everyone else to suffer forever? How do you think we should address that sort of objection?
One of the things I think is a repeated theme in my book, and it comes up in this chapter on hell, is this idea that what you find reasonable, what you find worthy of your belief, is dependent on what you already believe before you start. Yeah. In other words, it's depending on your worldview. So when you look at something like the doctrine of hell, the doctrine of hell is not going to make sense on any view of the world. It's only going to make sense on the Christian view of the world. If you take the average person's view of God, which is sort of a Santa Claus in the sky, big lovable teddy bear kind of guy who just wants you to be happy, and you take the average person's view of themselves and of humanity, which is generally good, and I make a few mistakes, but hey, we're human, that's the way it goes, then hell is totally incomprehensible.
Right.
It seems barbaric. And actually, I would agree. Given that view of God and given that view of humanity, hell is terrible. Makes no sense at all. But what if you're not right about God and humanity? What if God is different than that? What if he's much more holy and just than that? And what if we as sinners are much more guilty than we realize? Then suddenly hell doesn't look so implausible anymore. And so I just make the point in that chapter that you can't just say, I don't like hell. That's not an argument. You have to say, does hell make sense on a particular worldview? And on the Christian world, it actually makes a lot of sense. The other thing I make the point about hell is actually, I think inherent in every person, believer or unbeliever, is that they kind of agree with the idea. What I mean by that is they want justice.
Right.
They want God to put all things right. And I think all human beings have that desire because it's built into us. And honestly, at the end of the day, that's what hell gives us. It tells us that God is going to set all things right someday.
It's just that we may be on the wrong side of that equation if this is pure justice and we ourselves are not pure.
That's right. I mean, everybody deserves that justice. And of course, this leads to the Christian message, which is the only way to escape that justice is to turn to the person who's accepted that punishment for you, namely Christ.
You write that every sin is a kind of cosmic treason, because at its root, sin is basically idolatry. What's the point you're making there?
I'm trying to push back on that point against this idea of sin as a mistake, or sin as an error, or sin as even just simple as doing something wrong. Because when we think of it that way, we think, well, golly, I'm a human. People make mistakes. Of course, I'm going to do things wrong. But no, sin is pure rebellion. It's idolatry in the sense you're worshiping another god. And the analogy the Bible gives is it's basically spiritual adultery. It's like being married and you have a husband who treats you really well and he loves you and he's given himself to you and he wants to be with you and you spurn him, reject him and run off with other men. That is no minor thing. That is a awful way to treat your spouse and actually
cause for divorce.
In every way, put yourself in a place where you'd be subject to judgment. And so I use that analogy. And of course, it's a biblical analogy to show the weightiness of sin. Sin is not just something wrong. It's a total act of rebellion against God. It's rejecting him and worshiping other gods effectively. And that's, God takes that seriously.
So do you think that one of the reasons that hell no longer makes sense to younger generations of believers in our day is that in reaction to what was perceived to be an overemphasis in American fundamentalism, many churches began to de-emphasize hell or just stop talking about it altogether? And so basically an entire generation grew up that never really heard sermons or Bible studies on the subject of God's wrath, but instead heard over and over again, you know, that God loves you and has a wonderful plan for your life. Do you think that's part of the equation?
Yeah, I think that's certainly part of it. I mean, you know, even in my own circles, as I think about it, there's not that many sermons I think I can remember hearing about hell.
Yeah.
And now, of course, not every passage in the Bible talks about hell, so it's not as if you'd get it every week.
But it is something Jesus talked about frequently, as you point out in your book.
Well, certainly, yeah. And if you're preaching through the Gospels and faithfully doing it, you're going to get there. So yes, there's certainly some truth that people aren't hearing about hell. I would probably also add to that, that people aren't just not hearing about hell. They're also not hearing about the other two factors, which is who God really is and who we really are. And I think most people just have a God that they've sort of made in their own brain.
Yeah.
He's the God I wish existed. His character and his actions and his proclivities are what I want them to be. Now, if you just worship a God of your own making, well, then he would never send anyone to hell. And so I think people really haven't been taught who God is either. And so the problem is they haven't been taught what hell is, but they haven't been taught who God is. And I think therefore hell is just incomprehensible. And I think, again, as I said earlier, I think they'd be right if their view of God was right. But if their view of God is wrong, well, then hell doesn't look so implausible after all.
Folks, you've been hearing from Michael J. Kruger, who is president of Reformed Theological Seminary in Charlotte, North Carolina. And we've been talking about his new book, Surviving Religion 101. Dr. Kruger, thanks so much for being my guest once again on the White Horse Inn.
Absolutely. Love the conversation. Thanks.
The White Horse Inn is a listener-supported broadcast. For more information about this program, visit us online at whitehorseinn.org. If you sign up as an innkeeper, architect, or reformer, not only will you get a complimentary subscription to our magazine, Modern Reformation, but you'll also get longer editions of every White Horse Inn broadcast. To find out how to join one of these support programs, click on the support tab of our website, whitehorseinn.org. You can also give us a call at 1-800-890-7556. That's 1-800-890-7556. We'll see you next time at the White Horse Inn.